Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
So it is my huge pleasure to be joined today on the podcast with Rebecca Skippage. She is a news editor and an anti-disinformation lead at the BBC. She heads up a team of people at BBC Monitoring that specialise in spotting and investigating global misinformation, although today she's speaking in a personal capacity. And Rebecca, in 2020, you started a fellowship at the Reuters Institute to explore best practices in communicating with people around the world and finding ways to kind of link people who are not being reached by public service media networks with real information. And you published a fantastic report called The Role of Public Service Media in a Fight Against Disinformation. This is one of, I think, the great fights, so to speak, of our age. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
I'd love to start, if we can, with a bit of your background. How did you get into the BBC? How did you get into anti-disinformation? Yeah, tell us how you got here.
Well, it's a pretty well-worn path. I started many years ago as a BBC trainee in Newcastle. I worked on Radio Newcastle. I was a reporter, and I have to say, local radio, which is still very, very close to my heart, is a place that you learn your trade incredibly quickly, and with a lot of very good people around you. And I sort of moved around the BBC for the next sort of few decades, working at the main network news. I worked on a lot of the kind of the big set pieces that the BBC were involved in, like the Olympics, the torch relay as well. And I eventually ended up rather sort of circuitously at BBC Weather, where I launched a product called BBC Weather Watchers, which was all about crowdsourcing. And I became really interested in the sort of the notion of speaking to our audience in a different way. And then when the role came up at BBC Monitoring, that was something that I was sort of keen to sort of take on as well. So I started at Monitoring. And for those of you who haven't heard of Monitoring, and most people, frankly, even within the BBC at some point haven't, it is a network of about a dozen bureaus, international bureaus, about 200 journalists, and we monitor open source media and tell the story of what's going on in that country. And it's been going since the Second World War, when they were monitoring open source media that the Germans were broadcasting. So sort of propaganda, it was called, or fake news, as you might call it now. So when the BBC decided a few years ago, you know what, we need to be on the front foot here. This is, as you say, one of the big fights of our time, and the BBC is perfectly well placed to be leading on it. They came to the head of World Service, came to Monitoring and said, you know, do you want to set this up? And I jumped at the chance because it was an opportunity, you know, to really be at the front of the information fight. And also to, as I say, sort of have this conversation with the audience about what is it that's bothering you and how can we use our journalistic skills and the kind of platform and reach that the BBC has to fight against the bad information.
What a hot topic. I mean, I think a couple of years ago, people were talking about, do we live in the post-truth age, which was pretty horrifying. And it feels like we're making some progress towards not being in the post-truth age, which is great. And I think the work that you're doing is a really important part of that. And as you're doing this work, you've talked about how people from less privileged parts of the population are much less likely to digest their information, to get their news from mainstream news media, from public service broadcasters like the BBC. One of the things that exercises us at Genomics England as close allies of the NHS is around equal access to genomic healthcare or to healthcare more broadly. the BBC obviously has that same mission around access and, you know, the good Reithian principles of inform, educate, entertain, and so on. Why is that, that we see this disparity in more privileged or less privileged communities and where people turn to for their information?
I think it's really interesting, and I think information inequality is, you know, actually something again at the heart of the issue as far as disinformation sort of fighting is concerned. And of course, yeah, you guys are rooted in the UK, but you see this writ large elsewhere around the globe in a huge way. And really, the sort of the areas, the countries that have public service media, such as, you know, as we do in this country, have a huge advantage over some countries where the media is very, very state controlled or controlled by the people who hold the purse strings, and so on. But I think, you know, to your point about why it is, the bit that's in my paper that you've mentioned is something from the Reuters Institute, and they said less privileged parts of the population are significantly less likely to turn to news media than their more privileged counterparts. And that was with reference to COVID information. But I think we can kind of extrapolate sort of generally from that. I think there is a wider picture there, which is that the overall trend is down as far as news consumption is concerned. So we are consuming less of it, particularly on mainstream media. And a lot of that's got to do with the fact that the way that we are networked, the way that our information sort of ecosystem works is completely different to how it was, you know, frankly, 5-10 years ago, let alone, you know, 30-40 years ago, when certainly when I was a kid, you know, you'd sit down and you watch the news with your mum and dad, or and they'd read a paper. It was a set time, you know, and you believe what you were being told. And it's completely changed. You know, we all now basically get our information through something that is in our pocket, that is, you sort of scroll through it and you're like, oh, there's a picture of a cat. Oh, there's a picture of my niece. Oh, you know, here's something about COVID information. So your brain is not calibrated to think this is something serious that I should absorb. There's less trust in the media, there's less trust in the news, and we could go on and talk about that for another half an hour, but I will just leave that subject there. But I think particularly as far as less privileged folk within our community are concerned, there is something that the media can do, news media can do to be better, frankly. We can sort of reflect and represent different communities and produce material that is more relevant to people who don't necessarily come from privileged backgrounds, because I think that the way to engage people is to tell stories that have relevance to their lives, rather than this kind of, you know, again, this kind of top-down sense that we remember maybe from being kids of just listen to this because it's good for you. It's like, you know, that has passed and we need to move on with that.
Yeah, that kind of paternalistic view of we speak, you listen.
Now, right.
I mean, on the subject of disinformation, our kids actually didn't believe us when we told them that there used to only be 3 or 4 TV channels, and you'd have to sit down. If you wanted to catch the news, you'd actually have to sit down at 6 o'clock or 9 o'clock and watch it when it was on. They're like, yeah, right.
One of my younger colleagues said to me, a typewriter, I think my grandmother had one of those. And that really brought it home to me how much things had changed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But one of the themes that has come out in your work, which I love, is kind of taking the fight to the misinformers, so to speak, and using some of the techniques that have emerged in the last 5 or so years around, you know, memes and short video clips and things that kind of quote unquote go viral. I don't think anyone will talk about that as a good thing in the post-COVID age. Tell us a little bit about the people who are on the front foot in trying to use these techniques kind of for good, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is definitely a place for a kind of 2000 word. This is a deep dive into something that's really interesting, whether it be the kind of the Russian ecosystem and the Kremlinology, easy for me to say. You know, people are interested in that sort of stuff. But also, you know, there are plenty of people for whom that actually isn't their cup of tea. And so you need to be able to, you know, reach people where they are and in the manner in which they are ready to digest. You know, your kids couldn't understand that, you know, you actually had to wait for something. They want it there when they want it, in the kind of snackable format that they're ready to digest news and information. And yeah, I spoke to people from around the world, who were kind of in this space and doing really good work. And the three things that they kept coming back with were, you've got to understand your audience. You can't just assume that you know what's good for them. You've got to understand the way they're networked. You've got to understand that, you know, we all absorb information through TV, through radio, through chat apps, through offline communities, through everywhere. And as a result, we need to change the way that we're sort of interacting. They also said you've got to build community, because the way that we, again, absorb information is, you know, it started off being, you know, chatting to people in the pub or over the fence or whatever. And it's now in WhatsApp groups, or it's in Facebook groups. And it's that sense of, you can trust each other because, you know, we created this community and we all trust each other. And the disinformation merchants, the conspiracy theorists, are really brilliant at doing this, especially the conspiracy theorists who say, look, there's a kind of, you know, evil new world order against you, but, you know, we know what's going on. So join our gang and you can be part of that too. And I'm not saying that we sort of need to necessarily do the same, but for good. But there are definitely things that you can learn about making people feel kind of, you know, included. And the other thing that we were told is focus on the storytelling. So this is to your point of, you know, creating memes and creating really interesting little digital videos, and, you know, be funny, be irreverent, you know, show what's going on behind the scenes and put it where people are. You know, if people are on Facebook, it needs to be on Facebook. If it's on, you know, Twitter or TikTok or Instagram or whatever, that's where the good information needs to be alongside the bad information. You know, there's no point having it on a kind of highfalutin website that people aren't going to see. You know, we need to be out where it is, learning from the disinformation merchants, learning from the bad guys, and stealing their tricks and using them against them, but for good.
Absolutely. Like sort of jujitsu techniques. To that point about take the information to where people are, it seems that there's a, and also I guess to the point about community, it seems that there is a magic still to place, that being local is still relevant. One of the things that we're working on a lot at Genomics England is engaging with communities who've historically been underrepresented in healthcare research data sets, which these days is now having an impact, meaning that some of the personalized medicine techniques that are emerging are less well trained on those populations, just like the sort of machine vision thing that's only trained on white male faces is useless at recognizing people of color or women and so on. And as we're trying to engage with those communities at a local level, coming to them, listening, being in dialogue and so on, from your disinformation work, what have you learnt about useful ways of trying to have those conversations?
I mean, the good news is you're absolutely right. Being local is absolutely the way to do it. Again, sort of, it's not so much top down, but kind of centre out, doesn't work at all. The other sort of bit of good news is that the disinformation merchants have beaten this path and discovered it works very well. So you know, as far as an information network is concerned, that it's effective. So you'll see, for example, we're seeing quite a lot of offline disinformation. So leaflets through letterboxes, people in sort of market stalls, you know, giving out stuff and saying this is, you know, very relevant to your kind of local town and so on and so forth. And I think that the key thing, as you say, is to sort of work within the already established community groups. There's no point coming in and saying, you know, we think this is exactly what you should be doing. So for us, we're working a lot with our local radio colleagues. So there are 30 odd local radio stations. They are absolutely plugged into the heart of their communities, much more so than any other part of the BBC that I've been involved with. And we're working with them at the moment, and we've got a project coming up in a couple of weeks' time, saying, you know, to the listeners, what is it that you're concerned about? You know, what disinformation are you seeing? You know, are you seeing scams? Are you seeing things that worry you? Are you seeing things that pop up in your local WhatsApp or your local Facebook groups or your WhatsApp family groups? You know, tell us about it, and we will help you. And I think from a kind of disinformation perspective, this allows us to see whether there are some sort of almost like universal things, whether there are things that are, you know, just, you know, generally in common, and then we can provide resources to, you know, inform people and empower them so that they don't feel so nervous about things in the past, but also whether there are things that are specific to either particular areas or particular groups of people, and in which case, again, you know, tailor our interventions to those sort of particular folk. I mean, you'll have seen a lot of the vaccine hesitancy has been around, you know, some things which particularly affect certain either religious groups or certain groups that come from, you know, certain backgrounds. And after a bit of kind of, you know, not quite sure what should be doing, the government then came out with, you know, some really brilliant work whereby people who represent those groups, people who were role models for those groups of people, saying, you know, I'm doing it, you should too. And that's, you know, it's so obvious, but if you see somebody who looks like you and sounds like you saying, I'm going to do this, then you are much more likely to do it as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned offline techniques like leaflets and so on. One of the things I was really struck by through the lockdowns was just going to parks or other public spaces. One of the techniques that people who were spreading disinformation or conspiracy theories about COVID seemed to do all the time was just put stickers everywhere saying this will change your DNA and kind of ruin your life, or this will implant a chip in you that means you can be monitored, and then a QR code. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting, this link between a very old school thing of basically graffitiing or sort of putting sticks on things, and then a QR code to then link to the video. And it would be great to see people then, I guess, oversticking those with like shocker alert kind of vaccines work, you know,
yeah. QR code to some of our marvelous marvelous debunks that we do. we have a very comprehensive sticker collection, yeah, at the BBC disinformation team. We've also got a nice slew of newspapers which have gone through people's letterboxes and leaflets and so on and so forth. But there is something about, you know, that almost like, as you know, old school way of doing things again, which people seem to respond to. And alongside that, you've also got something that I think we started seeing about 9 months ago, which is the complete polar opposite, incredibly slick pseudo-scientific videos that appear on YouTube. Sort of, you know, they are very long, 60, 90 minutes. Plandemic was one of the key first ones, whereby you have lots of people in white coats and stethoscopes talking pseudoscience about how the pandemic is all made up and, you know, the conspiracy theories around it. And we've also seen this sort of technique used around anti-vax, and it's really believable. We've done quite a lot of work in debunking a lot of those things as well. So you get the really old school, here's a sticker, and you get the really kind of, you know, a cutting edge, you know, here's a really sort of groovy, flashy documentary style. Yeah, it's all over the place. It's tenacious stuff.
I noticed recently that we actually got a very old school leaflet through the post, which had five or six products on each page and kind of a big yellow starburst thing saying 20% off. I was like, oh God, I haven't seen one of these for ages. And it was from Amazon. Clearly people who think a lot about these kind of things are experimenting with all of these different techniques.
There we go. Maybe that's what you should be doing, going out leafleting.
Exactly. But I guess at the more high-tech end of this, we read a lot about WhatsApp groups being used as a source for disinformation. Have you seen any examples of taking part in any situations where either WhatsApp groups or other kinds of social networks are being used to try to deliberately spread correct information or to try to counter disinformation? And how do you insert that into those environments without it seeming odd and out of place?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly it. Again, we're back to the kind of, you know, take your medicine stuff. Unless it's authentic and organic, crikey, it's just, you know, it's like a teacher trying to be trendy or something like that. It's just cringeworthy. So yeah, I mean, WhatsApp, there have been some good work around, it was information about, let me try and get this right, I think it was about the Indian election that we got out. There was a project run by the BBC that sent out lots of correct information when there was a lot of disinformation sloshing around. WhatsApp have changed the way they operate now, so you can't do that as effectively. You can no longer do one to many is the kind of, you know, the technique that we need to use for that sort of thing. So we're having to find other ways of doing it. We're sort of experimenting with using things on TikTok, on creating memes, on putting things in Facebook groups, you know, using our sort of traditional platforms as well. So local radio and regional telly, and we get a lot of our stuff out also just on, you know, regular social media. We've got some fantastic reporters who work in this area who are really becoming known for, you know, being the people that you should go to if you're, you know, concerned about things, and they've developed really brilliant relationships with, you know, the people that follow them that say, I'm worried about this, how about this, you know, and they sort of, you know, send it in, and that's how we find out that things are going on.
From crowdsourcing weather to crowdsourcing disinformation. I love it. And how will we, if we step back in 5 or 10 years time, if we get this right, I guess, firstly, how will we know that it's working? And second, what would a world free of disinformation look like in, say, 10 years time? You know, like, was it CFCs in the 80s that were in kind of aerosol cans? You know, yeah. We won that one, right? They were eradicated. If we imagine a world that we where we similarly, like, we win, how do we know if we're getting there, and what does it look like if we get there?
So we're not going to get there. I am not a pessimist by nature, but let me tell you, propaganda has been around for a lot longer than you and me, and we are not ever going to get to a stage where people aren't trying to persuade you to do something that you don't necessarily want to do. I think what we can get to a stage at is where we make sure that people have got the tools whereby they can check whether what they're seeing and reading and being exposed to is true or not. So there's some really interesting work going on using artificial intelligence, looking at proving the provenance of video and images. So you can see whether things have been manipulated or not. I am a huge believer in media literacy. I think we should be teaching our kids right from the year dot about how to stay safe on the internet, and also how to source things, how to question things, those really important critical thinking skills that increasingly actually we don't teach in schools. I'd bring those back as well, so you'd get lots of children doing what I did when I was little and just asking why the entire time. And yeah, I think we won't get to a stage where we eradicate disinformation. It would be a very, very strange world if we did. But we can definitely get to a stage where people are just much better equipped to be able to deal with it.
Let me ask you a question kind of as a member of the public rather than as an expert in disinformation. So we are,
okay.
this podcast series, this podcast series is an attempt to, I guess, engender something of a national conversation around genomics. We're big believers that, you know, this is a technology which is coming into the mainstream that most people only have the kind of vaguest of understandings about, and that we need to ask questions, listen to people, have conversations about it. If you became interested in genomics for one reason or another, either because you or someone you know got ill, God forbid, or you heard something about it and wanted to find out more, where would you look to find out more? And maybe now turning more to your area of expertise, how should we be thinking about putting useful information out there in ways that people will instinctively kind of reach out for it and grab it?
Well, I think the very fact that you're thinking that you want to do this is brilliant, because disinformation flourishes in an information vacuum. And what you need to do is to work out what is likely to be happening in the next 6 months, year, 5 years time, and make sure the information is out there in as many places as possible, in as accessible forms as possible, so that people can find it when they look for it, because everybody is going to do the same. They're going to Google. And so to having things there and available in digestible formats, in a variety of languages, in a variety of ways that people can either, if they feel more comfortable, kind of print things off or download them or hear them, or, you know, it just, you need to have kind of, a wide variety of resources available. And I would suggest that it's the way that we kind of hone these things to be most effective is by sort of constant iteration, constant review, constantly asking, has this been effective? And, you know, what we can tend to do as you know, broadcasters or professionals is spend, you know, an awfully long time and perhaps some money in making something that we think is marvelous. Then we send it out and that's it. No, don't do that. You know, fail fast, review, move on, and learn from what it is that you've succeeded or not, and be prepared to be iterative and be prepared to be wrong. One of the things that we're trying to do is try new formats, try new platforms, try speaking in a voice that maybe isn't traditionally BBC and maybe we feel a little bit uncomfortable doing it. But in order to reach the people that we want to reach, we've got to do it. So it's better to feel a bit uncomfortable, but get the right information to the right people.
Inspiring marching orders. Rebecca, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. And for all of our sake, best of luck in all of your endeavours in countering disinformation.
Thank you so much. It's been my absolute pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.